Hey everybody, welcome to Crew Call with Mike Rose, Volume 2-4. This is our April podcast here. My guest this month is Otto Vondrak, editor of Railroad Model Craftsman and Railfin Railroad and God only knows what else. So we're going to find out. We're going to get the whole lowdown on Otto Vondrak today. How you doing, Otto?
I'm good. How are you, Mike?
Not too bad. Otto and I were comparing beginning to compare Hectic Mondays. And I said, you know what, let's talk about that on the podcast. I started my Monday with a leak in my water system.
Oh no.
Yeah. I have a well here and, you know that I'm working on an article for you. And, my plan today was having completed the weathering on the structures and some of the detailing that kind of, you know, needed to be done before I had some what I would consider final photos. I was going to go in there and take my final photos today. And when I went into that section of the train room, which was sort of the original train room, water on the floor, which is never a good sign.
That's never a good sign, yeah.
And I have a well, so it has filters because they have a high iron content here. And it turns out there was like this pinhole in one of the nylon nuts on one of the fittings. And, you'd think that would be a nothing thing, but it's definitely not one of those go down to Home Depot and get a part for it. And
right.
And after talking to my plumber and after talking to the local water pump guy, turns out I got to get the big boys to come down and it's going to be something that should cost a buck. That's going to cost me $300.
Oh, wow.
So that was my Monday. What was yours like?
Monday here at the office is usually just pretty much everybody playing catch up. Like Mike mentioned, not only do I work on Railroad Model Craftsman, I'm also associate editor for Railfan and Railroad. So, you know, we're spending all Monday getting our ducks in a row and checking on stories. Right now we're in the middle of our production cycle for both magazines. So I just feel like I've been in a number of phone calls and conferences today. I know I was doing a FaceTime conference with a author in California and we were working over some of the details of his story and then calling up a couple of columnists today and working with some authors for Railroad Model Craftsman. So it's just been one thing after another, but it's still fun. It's still exciting. So it's, but it's just, you know, man, those Mondays trying to catch up, it sure gets you after a while.
And it's supposedly a holiday today, but you'd never know it. You know, I mean, you said here in the office. So are you not working from home at this time?
No, that's a misnomer. It's, I've worked from home for the last 10 years.
Okay.
Since I started working for, Carson's Publications doing Railfan and Railroad. I've worked from home. In fact, everyone at White River, we all work out of home offices. I think people think we have some big glass steel building, you know, in Kansas City. But the only thing that's really down in Kansas City is our accounting and warehousing. All the editors actually work remotely from their home offices for all the magazines.
Nice. So you are really ahead of the curve and I guess uniquely prepared for these modern times that we seem to be in.
Yeah, I didn't realize my lifestyle was already considered quarantine, so here we are. Yeah.
Well, you know, I often get accused of not leaving the compound here either. You know, I mean, I can get lost in my work, but it's been a little bit of a challenge even for me. You know, I'm going to be 64 in July, and I do have asthma, so we're treating it very seriously and being very, very careful. So, I mean, I haven't gone anywhere. I think I went to the pharmacy once in the past 6 weeks, and that's kind of basically been it. And, you know, we're sort of gathering our gear for the next run in a few days. But I think one of the biggest changes for me is I just, you know, haven't had any friends here and I haven't been to any friends' houses. I'm also in IT. So, I mean, I've been doing a lot of my work remotely for a long time also. So that much hasn't changed, but just the inability to see people in person, you know, the reality of, you know, we don't go to New York and see the grandchildren or the kids or my son in Florida. We can't select.
I remember that. I had friends once. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know where that goes, but I know in my case, I have been on a tear with the model railroad, and probably have gotten more done in the last 2 months than in any prior similar period ever, you know. And it's, you know, it's had its ups and downs, but for the most part, I enjoy throwing myself into it. And you know, there's only so much news you can read. So I like to go down there where it's always summer and sunny in Pennsylvania and just kind of get lost in it, you know?
Right, right.
Now, do you have your own layout also?
The closest I have to my own layout, I don't know if you remember the series of modules we were building for an article in Railroad Model Crash when we did that Consider the Commuter series, and I built a couple of modules as part of that project. So right now those modules are set up in my living room.
Okay.
And at least they're set up, but that's the closest I have. I have an apartment here, so, you know, not a lot of room for model railroading, and but at least, you know, I have the modules. I can go and mess around with them a little bit. You know, I've been playing around with details and structures, and that's as close I have to a home layout at the moment.
Right. But at least you get to do modeling, you know what I mean? So it's, I honestly think it would be very hard to be the editor of a magazine like RMC and not be a modeler. You know what I mean? Like you couldn't relate, I don't think.
No, totally. And it's one of those things. It's like, I forgot how much I do enjoy, building structures, laying track, making scenery, all that good stuff. When we were doing the series in RMC, it forced me to model under deadline.
Right.
And it was enjoyable. I liked getting back to it. I hadn't been involved for a couple of years, so it was a nice break to, you know, pick up the toolbox and start making models again.
How did the deadline aspect of it color your enjoyment?
it was tough because at the same time it was fun putting the I was building a couple of structures, I remember, for an article back in 2018. And this is before I was editor, and I had to get these two structures done for the article that I was writing. And I had to balance doing that with all my other duties, working on Railfan, doing marketing and advertising for the company, all these other things. And I had to block out a few hours each night to work on these structures, photograph them. So it was a little tense, but it was still fun. You know, my favorite part, I think, of building models is watching the pieces come together. You know, you crack open that kit box for the first time as just a bunch of parts. And then over a few hours, few days, few evenings, all of a sudden those parts turn into a structure. The structure gets painted, the structure gets detailed. And I think that's the fun, you know, and especially when you're kit bashing, you know, and you have an idea in your head of where the structure is going to go. And then when you finally see it realized in three dimensions, you know, so that part is still fun. And it's one of those things, I wonder if I didn't have that deadline looming over me, if I still would have done it, but I'm glad I did it. You know, another example was we finished up the series just in 2019, and I had to self-impose my own deadline because one of the projects was I showed how you could replicate a commuter train inexpensively, and I had I found an Erie Lackawanna AHM set on eBay for cheap. I think I found two E8s and three cars for $75, and I'm like, sold.
Wow.
Perfect. Yeah. And I was trying to replicate Erie Lackawanna and later Conrail operated a commuter train between Cleveland and Youngstown. And that train came off in 77, but in its last years, it was nothing more than an E8 and two coaches.
What an interesting thing to model. You know, I mean, you don't normally see something like that. And, you know, I'm a freight modeler, so I don't know like a heck of a lot about passenger, but I think there's a lot of interest in that out there.
Well, and that's why I was looking at it as a cheap and expensive project. And I looked at it, I wanted to model the Conrail version. And, you know, I got some decals together and I was going to, let you know, patch it up for Conrail. And the AHM model has two headlights on the nose. And if you look at any Erie Lackawanna E8, there's only one headlight. And I'm staring at it, and I'm like, you know, is this bothering me enough to remove that headlight.
There's the slippery slope.
That's right. And I'm like, yeah, it is, especially because the way the Erie Lackawanna Diamond is positioned on the nose and then the Conrail patch over it. And I'm like, yeah, I better get rid of this second headlight on the door. So I made it part of the article, you know, where I masked off the area, I carved off the headlight, sanded it smooth, put a little body filler. And now I'm like, oh no, now I have to paint it. And fortunately, I was able to find paints at my local hobby shop that were perfect matches for the AHM paint.
Wow.
So you can't even tell where one ends and the other begins. And then, to me, it was a simple decaling project to apply the Conrail numbers, you know, and all that. But it really changed the look of the model. And the AHM cars by themselves are not perfect. But the idea was to show, you know, like, hey, Mike, if you want to add a passenger train to your model railroad, you know, here's a $100 project. You know, you don't have to, you know, or if you really want to go whole hog and really do something that's more prototypically accurate, well, there's plenty of models on the market today that are more accurate, you know. But that was kind of funny. Like, here I am sitting on my, you know, at my kitchen table, like staring down this AHM E8, and I'm like, oh, is this really worth it? But, you know, in the end, the effect was worth it. And even though, you know, I hate to admit this, a lot of my modeling I build for photography. I was at a regional convention sponsored by the Central New York NMRA, and some folks recognized me and they said, hey, we loved your modules in the magazine. You want to join up with our Fremo group sometime and we can bring them out. And I'm like, oh no, it's very, very kind of you. I said, those are pretty much, I built those for photography.
Right. They're not designed to throw in the car.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like if I took more time and I could wire them up and I could make them work for sure. But, you know, a lot of times when I'm building something, it's to demonstrate a concept. It has to look good.
So it's almost a diorama more than a Fremo module.
At this point, yeah. And the way I built them, you know, we built them as 4-foot modules. I built two of the modules myself. My boss, George Riley, he built the other 4 modules. And we designed the whole project as a proof of concept. It's not that we expect you to build a 4-foot module, but a 4-foot module fit in the back of my Jeep Cherokee, you know?
Yeah. You Which start is kind of a prerequisite when that's what you drive.
Well, right. Think about, you know, if you want to build a 5 or 6 foot module, that's your prerogative, but how are you gonna transport it?
Right. So, are you gonna do rent a van every time you want to move it?
And that's one of the things we were thinking about. But when we did that series, it was really about a proof of concept showing that, look, even with these 4-foot modules, you have a completely functional and operationally challenging model railroad. And the challenge to the reader was you can take those and extend them, expand them, build more sections in between, but here's the basic building blocks for you to start with.
Sure. Well, you mentioned a couple of things there that I want to get in touch upon. You know, I'm a project manager by trade, so I typically don't have any problem setting a deadline for myself when I want to get something done. By the same token, the overarching consideration is I want to make sure it's fun. In other words, the last thing I want to do is wring fun out of my hobby just to get something done. It's never about getting it done. It's about, you know, making progress and seeing something through and enjoying the completion of something, but not at the expense of having fun doing it. You know what I mean? I don't know where I'd be if I lost the fun of this hobby. You know, that would be a tremendous loss to me, you know. But I think that, you know, unless you have unlimited time and unlimited money and simply don't care about the value of any of that, you know, you have to always keep in mind that whole is it worth it quotient, right? Like you were talking about with your nose headlight there.
Right.
And I had not that long ago, actually, a project that goes back to probably far back enough that it was pre-DCC. And the project was to put a couple of Proto 2000 GP30 shells on Kato GP 35 chassis back when, you know, different manufacturers operated differently, you know, the way their locomotives operated. And I wanted to be able to run the GP35 and the GP30s together. So putting them all on the same chassis made sense, right?
Sure, sure.
So I did so. In fact, at the time I didn't have a milling machine, and my friend Brian Banna did the milling of the Kato chassis to permit the Proto 2000 shell to fit onto it properly. And he sent it all back to me. Everything worked. And then I immediately got involved in something completely different. And they sat on a shelf for God only knows how many years, right? Maybe 8, 9, 10 years at least. And not that long ago, I got back to it. And I actually saw the project through, painted the shells, did the DCC install, and you know, posted a couple of photos of it somewhere, I forget where. And then a friend of mine pointed out that, gee, Mike, you know, you chose to model X Reading units, and I had the rain gutters and the right horns and all of that jazz. I completely overlooked the fact that the fuel tank was different.
Oh.
They had the small fuel tanks.
Right, right.
Now, on the Proto 2000 chassis, that would have been a snap. You just snap off the plastic fuel tank, that's the large one, snap on the small one. This, of course, was the Kato chassis, which is a solid hunk of metal.
Yeah, it's all molded in, right?
Right. So back on the shelf it went for X amount of time, and then I said, wait a minute, I've just got too much into this. I've got a milling machine now. I'm just going to bite the bullet and do it. So I took one of them completely. It's a finished model, right? So I took it completely apart, because if you're going to mill a frame, you have to remove everything. And milled it out to accept the small Proto 2000 fuel tank, and put a Cannon air reservoir on it, and did some piping, and ended up being a pretty nice looking model. But when I got done with it, and there was another one sitting there to do, I thought, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to take the rain gutters off, and we're going to renumber the thing, and we're going to have one of each here, because that will actually be less work than what I did, and arguably just as interesting, and maybe more so.
And I think that goes back to, as modelers, we challenge ourselves. And I think it was Alan McKelland who even pioneered, you know, the good enough mentality. You know, he's there, he's building the V&O and of, you know, a large railroad for operation. And he realized that there was going to be a certain threshold where the modeling has to be good enough, or else he's never going to get this railroad finished. He's never going to operate.
Right. You do have to make some hard choices there. And I know some people, like guys like Ken McCrory and even Mike Confalone. When I first saw his railroad up there, I mean, we're talking a long time ago, I went up there, and, you know, it's, have you seen it in person?
I have not yet seen it in person, okay. But fun fact.
Well, I know you drew the map for it.
I designed the logo for the Allegash Railway.
Well, how did that 6 degree of separation thing come about? You know, when he told me that, I said, oh, I have to ask Otto about this.
I've known Mike off and on for years. We have a good professional relationship where I had been contributing to Railroad Explorer for several years.
Ah.
And, you know, I think we had crossed paths at some point. He's like, you know, hey, I'm working on some model railroad projects. Would love your input. And he was very nice. We worked on projects, his old railroad, the Woodsville Terminal.
Oh, yes.
I designed the logo for that. We based that on, you know, some New England short lines. You could definitely see the allusion, you know, to those New England short lines he was trying to emulate.
Oh, absolutely. And then the artwork goes to Jimmy Abbott, and presto, instant decals.
I love also, like, I bought recently... I think Tangent did a run of
the gondolas. Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, an Allegash gondola. And of course I bought one for my non-existent model railroad, but I thought it was so cool that, like, here's an evolution of my artwork now on a mass produced model. And that just,
right.
You know, it's just kind of like, look at me, pat myself on the back.
That is pretty cool though, you know.
But it was fun working with Mike, because he had such a clear, as he described the Allegash to me, and, you know, I understood completely what the concept was, and it helped me kind of forge what kind of look and feel for the artwork and the logo. And, you know, and then Mike's just taken it and the evolution, you can see the different paint schemes.
Oh yeah.
The way different diesels are painted over time.
I've experienced many of those in real time.
Well, and I also enjoy, that's actually something I learned. It's a concept I picked up from Tony Custer. I remember when he first introduced the Allegheny Midland, you know, and model railroader back in the mid 80s. And he specifically talked about how he had two different paint schemes for the Allegheny Midland to show the passage of time.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh,
which
that's
is
so
true
brilliant.
Of just about any railroad. I mean, even right. Union Pacific had some evolution.
Right. You see Union Pacific where it's like little shield, big shield, logo on the side, logo on the nose, logo. Right. Sometimes you put a motto, sometimes you put a road number, but it's, you can look at it all and still see it's part of the Union Pacific family.
Sure.
And what I liked about Tony Custer, you saw the Allegheny Midland models in the earlier, you know, nickel plate stripe paint scheme, but you could still tell it was an evolution and they were all part of the same family. Likewise with the Allegash, it's like whenever I see a photo of the motive power, it's like, yep, that's a logical progression, because think about how railroads decide how they're going to paint something when they're doing really well and really flush with money. You get really complex, multicolored paint schemes with pinstripes. And when you're on austerity budget, you go to a simple dip paint job with a single color. So,
right.
But that's part of what makes, that's what adds to the realism of these railroads, is that you apply the same considerations as the prototype, and that's what makes it believable.
Well, to get back to my very first visit up there, I went up there with my wife to, I guess, meet in person for the first time, because we'd been corresponding quite a bit. And when I went down to his basement, you know, it's a large basement, and then it also includes what used to be a two-car garage. So to me, it just looked like acres. And he only had basically the Woodsville terminal and a little bit more that were finished, and it was very well done. But I looked at all of this other track and bench work, and I said to my wife on the way out, I said, this guy's nuts. It's going to take him 10 lifetimes to finish this thing. And had he been employing the techniques that I was employing at the time, the old school stuff, because let's face it, I've been model railroading for half a century. You know what I mean? A lot of my techniques go way back, you know. I'm, sure. I was from the, you know, screen wire and plastic cloth school at one time, you know.
Oh, even my first model railroad, I took sawdust from my dad's shop and dyed it green because
there you go.
That's what the book told me to do. So
I remember the boxes of lifelike green and brown dyed sawdust that you could right. You could buy.
Sure.
So over time, I started to watch what he was doing up there. And of course, he was working at the kind of frenzy that people accuse me of now. but also, he was employing a lot of newer techniques, and I just saw how he was getting things done. And I also saw how he would not have any sacred cows, and he would do something, and if he didn't like it, he'd rip it out and throw it in the driveway and redo it. And the kinds of techniques that he was using lent itself to the rapid recreation of the scene the way he wanted it, you know? And that wasn't lost on me, you know? And at the time, I guess when I first met him, I wasn't even a full prototype modeler. I was proto freelance.
Sure.
And the whole thing kind of flipped around. One day roaming around in Pennsylvania, I found my prototype, and next thing you know, I was redoing my layout to best represent that prototype. And you know, time marches on to the point where I've even put an addition on in order to really capture the whole interaction of the area that I want, that I began to understand having gone down there a lot and met people down there and done all the research. And you know, it is a spaghetti bowl that I model, so it took a while to kind of get that in my head, but it's also a very interesting thing operationally. So
sure.
I never could have done, I mean, basically I've redone every square inch of the railroad in about 6.5 years. and we're probably talking about 1,800 square feet of model railroad. So about half of that it was built new, and about half of that was redone. Could never have done it had I not employed modern techniques and the right attitude about, I think, what truly matters, and to let go what really doesn't in the end result. You know what I mean? And
I see guys that are
fine modelers, you know, and they're building incredible, like museum quality detailed models. And I greatly admire that. And I've done some of that myself in the past, but you cannot do that and build a gigantic model railroad. You just can't. They're mutually exclusive.
I think people get caught up in what it means to be involved in the hobby because, you know, they look down on ready to run models, or, you know, I sometimes call them placeholder models. You know, perfect example is, you know, I'm building these modules and they represent a suburban neighborhood. And I already decided there were going to be some buildings I was going to build, but in the interest of time and completing the scene, I was going to buy some ready-built buildings. And, you know, I got two of the Atlas suburban colonial homes, and I got one of the Woodland Scenics, you know, Victorian home. And yep. I'm just going to take them out of the box, plop them in the scene, and the scene will be done.
Weather them up a little bit. And...
Right. So in like, you know, in the time to come, I can always add weathering washes, details, whatever. But, you know, the point is, like, it's not about taking shortcuts. It's like, these are the structures I wanted. They represent the scene I want. This is serving my purpose. I'm able to move to the next level. And I built other structures for that project. But it's like, okay, I'm spending 1 week building these structures. I don't have time to build every structure in this project and still make, and, you know, for me, it was a deadline issue. But
sure.
I don't know if you recognize the name Harold Russell.
That name I do not know.
Harold Russell, author of hundreds of prototype articles, many scale drawings in Model Railroader and Railroad Model Craftsman.
Oh, wait a minute. That does ring a bell now. Yes. Yes.
And he's an O-scale 2-rail modeler, lives here in Rochester. I got to visit with him recently. We've been friends for years. And he's showing me his layout and, you know, very nicely done O-scale 2-rail layout, lots of scratch-built structures. And he points to one scene, and I recognized, you know, some of the buildings being, you know, some ready-built O-scale Woodland Scenics buildings, you know, in this one corner. And I didn't say anything about it. I'm like, whatever, the layout looks nice, and it's, you know, your layout's complete. It's great. You know, you have 95% scratch built buildings and these two Woodland Scenics buildings, whatever. And it didn't detract from my experience. And it was Harold who pointed them out and drew attention to them. He's like, oh yeah, see those buildings? Well, I needed to get my, you know, I wanted to finish this corner of the neighborhood, and I just decided it was more important to be done than it was to spend.
Scratch build, you know, two more houses. Exactly.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mention, Iris, like, in the whole, know, in, go ahead.
Well, as I say, you know, it's one of those things where Harold's like, I just want to enjoy my railroad. And it's like, he's been building models for going on 60 years. You know, you can crack open any model railroad or Railroad Model Craftsman, any of the popular magazines, you'll see his articles and drawings. It's like, I don't think that there are rules. I think, you know, everyone's like, oh, you're not taking seriously if you don't hand weigh your track. Oh, you're not taking seriously if you use kits or ready-built buildings. And it's like, whatever gets your railroad to a point where you can enjoy it, I think is more important than...
That's how I define success.
Sure.
But right. In other words, yeah. I'm there. I'm trying to please myself. I have my own level of criticality. And if you happen to like that too, great. And if you don't, that's fine too, you know?
Well, I think this goes back to like me staring down the second headlight on that unit, right? It's like, the more I thought about it, I'm like, no, it's worth the extra effort because clearly Irulakwana
units
did not have two. Right. It's part of the image. Irulakwana E units did not have two headlights like that. And
right.
Especially not the unit I'm modeling. And I can't in good faith put that out there and be like, Oh, good enough. Now I think the AHM model as a whole, good enough.
And Reading GP30s didn't have large fuel tanks.
Right.
Now,
So it's
our ace in the hole about structures.
yeah.
I really enjoy building structures, and in fact, you'll see when the article gets submitted, all of the different grain facilities that are going to be in the article. They range from complete scratch builds to elaborate kit bashes to stuff that I've done and stuff that I've also outsourced, and get to get them all to get them all done. And I, so there are things on my railroad that I dearly wanted to build and be involved in myself and see all the way through. And then there were a lot of other structures that just didn't matter all that much to me, but were important to the railroad. And the guys introduced me to Rich Cobb, who has been a great resource for a lot of really nice model railroads, like Mike Confalones and Jim Dufour's and Neil
Sure.
Schofield's, and it could go on and on. Ken Karlowitz, everybody is using Rich, and I can go to Rich and say, Rich, I need a row of houses on this street for the village of Laceyville, and here are the pictures of these houses that I took walking down the street, snapping a photo of each one. And I just feed these photos into the Rich Cobb machine, and then they just start arriving, and they're well done. They're detailed enough. He puts lighting in them. And more importantly, they're structures I never would have gotten around to building.
Right.
And certainly not in the quantity that he supplied. So
Well, and think about it too, when
him
you're building
doing
a model
that,
railroad, you prioritize the structures, right? The ones you interact with or the ones you operate with, or
sure, the
maybe the key
Consignees.
structures. Yeah. But a bunch of neighborhood houses, is that so important right now?
They'd be vacant lots. I kid you not.
Right.
Had Rich not done that. So I have leveraged his ability to quickly and accurately just make something out of nothing, and he's got the methodology down. And he's usually got a lead time, but if you need something within, he'll work with you. And we'd all be screwed without Rich Cobb, because he has provided, he has filled this niche that would otherwise have taken years of man hours to replicate. You know what I mean? So
Sure,
I
sure.
definitely want to give him props for that. And in fact, he had a hand in two of the five grain facilities that you'll be seeing, for portions of them, for key portions of them, so that I could do some other stuff.
And I think that's great when you have friends who can chip in like that too. I remember, going to a friend's house, and he's pointing out all the structures. Like, yep, my friend built this, my other friend built that, and it's like, but you're trading skills. You're otherwise, helping each other, because it's like, I think one of the things we figured out early on with this hobby, if you're doing any endeavor bigger than a 4x8, right? It's like you need your friend's help.
Oh, absolutely.
You
And
need
on a
someone who
long
could,
enough
yeah.
timeline of interaction, inevitably you end up helping each other with something. Almost like I sometimes it's like a barn raising. I went to Neil Schofield's one time, and he and I and another friend of his built a helix, and none of us had ever built a helix before. So I enjoyed it just from the sheer new experience in engineering aspect of it.
Right.
And I do a lot of engineering type stuff up at my Confalones too, track work and new sections of the layout and things like that. And he's often down here helping me out with various things. He did some of the ballasting in on the DNH in a new section of the layout, and did some of the tie coloring at Avoca Yard for me, which was, and I was happy to have him do it, because there's an unlimited amount of that to do. So
Right.
And, you know, he's got some of my old structures that I no longer needed up on his layout at East Dixfield. And you know what? I enjoy seeing them there a lot more than I did seeing them underneath the layout gathering dust. You know what I mean? So
absolutely.
You know, it's just nice to see that he's got some of my cars up on his railroad. I've got some of his down here that we've made deals on. And that's, I think, part of the fun of it for us. You know what I mean? And sometimes you have things that you did that you liked, but they just don't fit anymore. And it's nice to be able to visit them once in a while.
Totally. Yeah.
Now you and I got talking a little bit when you got onto the podcast group and you started seeing some of the pictures that I was posting of that huge area I was doing with the Avoca Yard and the Kerr-McGee tie treatment facility. I'm at a stage with that now where I've basically moved on to another area. It's not done, but you know what it is? It's presentable. And that's a term I use a lot, but it's kind of what I'm shooting for in most areas before I go back and really do another round of bringing it up to an even higher level. I have a hard time ignoring vast areas of just bare bench work in order to add small details to a scene. You know what I mean? I kind of mm-hmm. want to get my whole, just a personal choice. I want to get my whole railroad presentable. Although there are individual scenes that as the mood and urge strikes me, I go back to and sort of gradually and continuously improve. But I like to say that there's not one square foot of the railroad that's I would consider completely done, except for the interior sections that I did in that Avoca area, because I had to sort of build my way out from there. So I kind of enjoyed getting those areas basically done for a change before moving on, you know. Right. And the only thing that I'm waiting for now, I had ordered some chain link fence for around Kerr-McGee from Bernie Kapinski, Alchem, you know. And his etcher has deemed his jobs non-essential at this time. So his etcher is making him wait. And Bernie's making me wait, but he's got the gates and the etched chain link fence that I need to really finish off that particular property. So I'm hoping that maybe over the next couple of months I can get that in and get back to completing that scene. In the meantime, as you may have seen on the group, I painted all of Taylor Yard, and that means I can do some ground cover there as the mood strikes me. You know, Mike Confalone is giving me a hard time about that because he thinks I should just run the railroad, and he's got a point. I really miss it. I tend to get on these long construction binges, and when that happens, you know, you get a fair amount of work to get back to the stage of cleanliness where you can run your railroad again. But with all of this isolation thing going on, he's doing something interesting that we're going to talk about next month, and that is he's doing an entire op session cycle solo, and it's taking him weeks to do it, right? Because he's doing the work of five or six guys over 5 or 6 hours,
right?
And he's just doing it a little bit each day. And as soon as he talked about that, I thought, that's really interesting. Because there's jobs on my own railroad that I've never done, you know, and that maybe that seems crazy, but, you know, the crew comes over, different people tend to do different things.
Right.
And as the layout owner, you know, you're sort of orchestrating the whole thing. Plus, I like watching the whole system kind of function as an entity for the first time. You can only do that when you have a bunch of friends over, right? Because all the simultaneous activity. But I'm going to take a stab at it myself. He's kind of challenged me to do it, and I think it's a good idea, you know. So I think I'm going to start out switching out Mahoopany, and then I'm going to run the mainline freight that picks up there, and then it's going to continue to Pittston Yard, and then I'm going to be the Pittston Yard guy. And I think it's going to take me probably a month to do it also, and I think it'll be enjoyable. So the kind of work that I'm doing on the layout now, I'm trying to do it in such a way that I don't have to take a week just to clean everything up. You know what I mean?
And right, right.
That's the approach I'm taking now. I think that big, you know, in terms of square footage area that I was working on at Avoca, that just had to be attacked because it was sort of this all-encompassing effort. And I've never built that many square feet of finished scenery at one time before, and it was one scene, you know what I mean? It had to sort of just be driven to completion, you know? I think the rest of what I have to do on the layout will lend itself a lot more to the incremental approach, you know what I mean? Because I'll be working on 2 or 3 foot deep scenes, not 8. That was orders of magnitude different.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about what you were up to before you became a magazine editor. What's your background?
My background is in graphic design and marketing.
Ah, okay.
I went to Rochester Institute of Technology up in Rochester, New York. Studied graphic design and printing, and also American history. And I worked for big companies, small companies. Ended up moving back to the New York City area. Worked for a little company called Snapple. Don't ever have you heard of them?
A little company.
Yeah, they make iced tea or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Actually worked for in their packaging division, like designing labels and packaging for Snapple and all their other brands. That was a lot of fun.
Sounds like it.
Never really far from publishing. One of my first jobs out of school, I worked for a magazine in Rochester. And then when I moved back down to New York, I worked for a couple magazines, one called Westchester and one called Hudson Valley. And they were kind of lifestyle magazines about those areas.
Sure. We have them around here too.
Yeah, sure. So, you know what I'm talking about. And because I've always been interested in magazines. I think it was growing up reading magazines like Model Railroader. And, in back of my mind, I'm like, oh, boy, I want to work for Model Railroader someday. And, it's interesting. And I over the years, I got to know some people that worked at Kalmbach, and submitted one or two things over the years to their sister publication Trains,
Mm-hmm.
And all the while, I'm still working my regular jobs in marketing and graphic design. I worked for an ad agency in Connecticut for a bunch of years. And the whole time, I start ramping up my contributions to some of the magazines. And one of my first published articles in a Model Railroad magazine was August 2000. I had an article about the Rochester subway and how to model it.
Hmm.
And that started a relationship with Railroad Model Craftsman and editor Bill Schomburg.
Sure.
They hired me to do a bunch of drawings over the years, sometimes technical drawings, sometimes layout plans. Sometimes Bill would get an article in, about a prototype. Oh, here's an interesting short line. And Bill would call me up, be like, can you design a track plan around the short line? I'm like, sure. And I love doing stuff like that. I love translating the prototype into a realistic track plan, So I always enjoyed challenges like that.
That is a challenge. I mean, I'm not a graphics design guy. And I spent a year coming up with the revamped track plan to include the addition. And basically I took my layout and just moved a hunk of it out there and then connected in between. But
sure,
the challenge of trying to do that protractors and pencils and graph paper. I greatly admire the people who can just, whip up these professional looking track plans.
Oh, I'm not even that precise. Something I've learned in design over the years is that if it looks good, it will probably operate well. We talk about form following function. If something looks well designed, it's probably going to work properly.
Mm-hmm. That assumes you have the correct eye for that.
Well, and I think, there's a certain amount of skill involved in design for sure. And when it came to translating the prototype to a model, that's going in eyes wide open, realizing in many cases you're not going to be able to incorporate every single function of the prototype. But if you incorporate the primary functions, you're going to get most of what you're trying to replicate here. And
deciding what to omit sometimes is half the battle.
that's correct. And it's like, unless you have like a Walmart sized basement to fill, and even if you did, I wouldn't envy you, because quickly I think you realize, you know, if you could replicate even a small short line railroad, bolt for bolt, stick rail for stick rail, you know, it would be overwhelming. You know,
Sure.
think about how, you know, even if you were modeling a 3 mile short line and every siding and every customer, that would be overwhelming for one person. I think people don't realize when we build our model railroads how much we automatically omit, because we realize not only the limitations of a room, just the limitations of yourself and the people you're working with. And
Sure.
but it was, you know, contributing stories to RMC and drawings and things like that. And a few years into that, I got tapped by Steve Barry. He's the editor of Railfan and Railroad. I started working on some freelance projects with him, designing the new logo for Railfan and Railroad was one of those jobs. That was kind of interesting. It's like, wow, my logo is going to be on a magazine. That's crazy.
That's cool.
And then, you know, it got to be the point where I was doing so much freelance work for Karsten's publications at the time. You know, I'm billing them more than 40 hours a week, and my job at the advertising agency, not my job, but just the agency, was just seeing a huge downturn in work. And I'm like, all right, I need to get out of here. And, you know, the time was right. I could work from home, work for the magazine. Let's do it. So I started working for Karsten's full time in 2011, 2010, 2011. And I was working for Railfan and Railroad primarily, and also doing some marketing and advertising work on the side and developing all of our websites. And then when we joined the White River family in 2014, I continued in that role.
That's when Bill retired.
Bill retired in 2013.
13, yeah.
Chris D'Amato was editor briefly
Right.
for a transition period through 2014. And in 2015, Stephen Priest became full-time editor for Railroad Model Craftsman. And then, you know, after a few years, Stephen found some opportunities he wanted to pursue. And, you know, we had some conversations. He's like, boy, Otto, I think you'd be great in this role. I said, that's super flattering. I don't know if that's really up to me, though. You know, I figured that's kind of up to Kevin and Nadine Udaly, the owners of White River. It's not really, I didn't really think I was a contender. You know what I mean? And at one point I reached out to Kevin. I said, boy, Kevin, I really would love to be involved in RMC, like maybe as an associate editor, you know, on staff somehow. And I was kind of like, you know, poking the door open with my foot. And Kevin's like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, oh, guess that's the end of that conversation.
So there was some dead air there.
Well, and it was funny because then, like, you know, after a month or two later, and still not having any real candidates for editor, you know, Stephen Priest calls me up. He's like, you know, Otto, you really need to throw your hat in here. I said, well, I kind of broached it with Kevin. He didn't seem interested. He's like, well, I just got off the phone with Kevin. You need to call him right now. And I'm like, oh. And I called Kevin. He's like, hey, how'd you like to be editor? And I'm like, okay.
I guess
Not
you caught
really
him on a
knowing what
bit.
I'm getting into, but knowing exactly what I'm getting into. And
You caught him on a bad day the first time.
you know, well, I think it was more, you know, I bet there was a lot more going on behind the scenes. I know Kevin had a short list of candidates he was working through, and we had some, you know, we of course asked around internally, but, you know, truth be told, if you know anyone at White River, all the editors wear several hats. We all do several projects simultaneously. So, you know, everyone at White River was pretty full up. But, you know, I had some follow-up conversations, and I explain my plan going forward, how we could make the time, how I could balance my time between the two publications. And I have a great staff to work with. You know, Harry K. Wong is my associate editor out in San Francisco.
My old friend, Harry.
Harry is so great. And he handles the front of the book is what we call it. He does all the product reviews, coordinates all the reviews. He also coordinates getting product samples in for Receiving Yard. That's our new product announcements. And he also coordinates our book reviews. So he handles all the timely information that goes up front. I handle all the feature editing. And then we recently just brought on Justin Franz as our associate editor.
Oh, and that's Tim's son, right?
Yes, that is yep. The Tim Franz. His son is joining the staff. He's also joining the staff of Railfan and Railroad.
Is this the official announcement?
It was official a couple weeks ago, but yes, no. Justin's been hitting the ground running, working for both publications. And Justin's going to manage a lot of our monthly columns. So that'll take some weight off of my plate and I can focus exclusively on feature editing.
Well, I have a couple of questions about being editor because
sure.
You know, I knew so Bill, I knew Bill for literally decades and really just everybody loves Bill. And
what I think a lot of people don't realize is that the editorial team of Bill Schomburg, Chris D'Amato and Jim Ankrum, we had the same editorial team in place for almost 30 years.
That's incredible.
And we've never had, if you look at the history of Railroad Model Craftsman, that was the longest tenure of any editorial team.
Oh, it's gotta be.
Yeah. So 30 years for Bill, Jim and Chris was pretty amazing. Yeah.
But you know, despite working with him for years, I think my first Craftsman article was probably in the mid-90s or something, and having many, many fine dining experiences with him, I still never got a good sense of what it took from the editor standpoint to put out a magazine of that quality month after month. I anecdotally, I picked up all kinds of, you know, stories of, you know, feverish and frantic late night sessions and, you know, cobbling it together manually in the pre-computer days and all of that. I imagine it's quite different now.
I heard stories back in the day. I mean, Jim Boyd was notorious of this, you know, being editor of Railfan and Railroad. And that was back in the days you're literally doing what we call mechanical paste ups. You're literally
right
pasting up each page, what it's going to look like, shipping that off to the printing company. They're taking photographs of those pages and making printing plates. But you had to reach, you know, as Boyd would tell you, yeah, the FedEx in Newton closed at 7, but you know, he could drive like a bat out of hell and make like literally practically like drive onto the tarmac at Newark Airport.
Jeez.
Hand a package up to a pilot. You know, I worked at a magazine even when I was working at Hudson Valley Magazine and Westchester Magazine, not long ago, like 2005 or so, we would make up the magazine electronically, but I had to burn a CD. And then that CD went along with a whole bunch of color proofs stuffed into a FedEx box. And I'm rushing to, like, you know, the FedEx, you know, facility at like 7:59, hoping to make the 8:01 cutoff, you know, because
we're using something like Quark to put it together.
We were using Quark Express in those days. And quite frankly, there were some aspects that were out of my control. I was a production manager in those days. And it was my responsibility to coordinate bringing in advertising artwork, getting the advertising placed and proofed and approved, working with the editors to get their, you know, designs in place and all that. And here I am, you know, I'm just the last link in line. And of course, you know, everyone would have, like, an ad salesman hands off his ad to me and is like, well, my job's done. It's like, no, wait, I need the ad artwork and I need your client to approve this. And, you know, so, you know, lots of late nights like that. These days, we're creating the magazine electronically. We're using programs like InDesign and Photoshop and Illustrator. And it's all electronic. We're making PDFs, and then those PDFs get uploaded. We use an online proofing system called InSight. Mm-hmm. And we look at the PDF online, and if it looks good, we approve it, and it goes to press.
Mm-hmm.
And I should point out that for Railroad Model Craftsman, my graphic designer, Todd Gillette, does an excellent job I let him handle that aspect of production. He does a lot of the design and layout for us. If he wasn't involved, I wouldn't be able to manage the publications like we do. But definitely having that proofing system where I remember just not long ago, like 10, 15 years ago, if I was working on Westchester Magazine, once I sent my CD off, they would send back a FedEx package full of literally blueprints made from the printing plates.
Wow.
And that was my last ditch. I could change type, but I couldn't really tell anything about tonality of photos because I'm literally looking at a blueprint.
Right.
But you know, I'd like, you know, mark up those prints and send them back. But, you know, I think we're fortunate to have this electronic process because it definitely does save time. You know, I work with an author and I get, you know, the text, the images, they're all electronic. We can look at them. I can give an author instant feedback.
Sure.
Hey, these photos are soft, or can you reshoot this, or, you know, whatever it is. And with digital photography, we can work that way pretty quickly. I'm looking at old issues of Railroad Model Craftsman from the 70s, even the 80s, reading columns by, you know, Tony Custer and Bill Schomburg, talking about how they would go to, you know, the NMRA National.
Mm.
And they would spend afternoon in the contest room shooting all the contest winners and then running out to a photo processor, getting their film processed the same day so that they could tell if they got the pictures or not. Because, you know, if you flew out to Denver for the convention and you come home and all your pictures are screwed up, you know.
I can't tell you how many dinner times or lunch breaks rather that I was helping Bill do that down in Cocoa Beach.
You know exactly what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
So, you know, now with electronic, you know, with all the electronic production and the digital photography, we don't have that as much. The thing that we've been trying to focus on, and one of the first things I brought back was a column called Company Photographer, which you might remember from RMC from the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a column about photography skills and how to photograph your models and how to think about projects. And it's not written by any one person. I have several people writing the column, and it gives lots of different points of view about equipment, technology, technique, because I want to show people that, you know, it's very easy to take pictures. You just have to, you know, take some time in doing it, because the biggest roadblock I get is I see someone's great model online. I'm like, wow, what a great project. Let's get that in the magazine. Well, I don't have any good pictures. I don't have a good camera. I'm like, you can do it. And I just want to show people how. I mean, even in our Consider the Commuter series, here's a big secret. I shot all of those photos with my cell phone.
Wow.
And some of the model scenes lack really good depth of field, but I tried to keep the majority of things in focus parallel to the plane of the phone. Again, these were just, are they the best photos? No, but it's better than nothing. And in certain situations, like I think for project photography, when I was building structures for that one article, I had my phone next to me and I'd take a few steps, grab the phone, take a picture. And for the most part, a cell phone can give you great in-progress project photos.
It's exactly what I do. And in fact, what you'll see is all of my work in process photos will be exactly as you describe. And then for the final photos, I drag out the big DSLR and the tripod and, you know, try to do it to the best of my ability.
And I'm still learning a lot of that. I don't have a digital DSLR. Mike, you're going to laugh. I still shoot slides for my hobby photography.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where do you get them processed?
I ship it out to Dwayne's Photo out in Kansas.
It's the one place doing it, right?
Well, it's, you know, even here in Rochester, we had a couple of local photo labs that were still doing E6 processing, but I wasn't happy with their quality. I used them like once or twice, and So I just ship it out to Duane's.
Well, isn't Rochester the home of Kodak?
I mean, I know, isn't that sad? And we don't have an E6 processor. It's really sad. Well, it was actually funny. I remember a while ago, I actually bought a new camera body, and the camera shop threw in a roll of Kodak print film. You know, here, test your body, make sure it works. And it was funny. It was easier for me to go to CVS, and I can still get 1 hour prints, C41 process, you know, Kodak color prints. Sure. But forget it if you want to find a slide processor. But it was funny. I was looking at in the May issue of RMC, which is just coming out now, I did an article comparing the Model Railroad at RIT, where we had the Model Railroad Club, comparing the layout that we built in the first 10 years and then tearing it down, and the layout that's currently under construction, comparing the two layouts. And I thought it was funny. We had an article in the October 2006 issue, a 10th anniversary visit to the layout. And I remember shooting that on Kodachrome, you know, with my camera, bringing out the lighting kits, you know, and doing all that, taking the slides, sending them out for processing, hoping they turn out right. And it was just funny comparing those photos from 2006 to photos I snapped with my cell phone or digital camera, you know, in 2015, you know, and I thought, wow, look how quickly we have come in just like 10 years, right?
Right. Actually, the cell phone camera defies all logic, because there's just no way it should be taking photos that good.
And I know, like, smarter people than me have explained how the sensors work, because I feel like a lot of times a cell phone more or less will record exactly what you see, the lighting conditions and everything. And when I was doing photography for my Consider the Commuter stories, I was shooting that outside, and you can't beat, like, full sunlight. These cell phone cameras do great. You know, I'm looking at the images in Photoshop, and it's, you know, stepped down to ISO 50, and they're sharp.
Mm-hmm.
What's also great about a cell phone is that I love visiting someone's layout. You just plunk your phone down and take some pretty decent shots, you know?
Exactly. And you can put it, you know, you can fit it into spots where you can get a camera.
Right.
And you've got a nice big viewfinder, I guess you'd call it at that point. And also, I think surprising depth of field usually.
And I think, and that usually comes with lighting. So, like, let's say I'm just casually visiting someone's layout, and I plunk my camera down, I get a couple of good shots with the room lighting, you know, and that's really more for my education, or maybe I share them on RMC's Facebook page or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have good, strong lighting, you know, lighting actually will affect how the camera reacts to depth of field. And that's actually something we're going to talk about in a future column, about how you can get better acceptable photos from a cell phone. The problem is sometimes when you're shooting projects, I was struggling with this. A friend of mine was reviewing a vehicle for the magazine, and we were trying to get, we used both our phones, and I'm like, I just cannot get both ends of this HO scale station wagon in focus. And I feel like such a failure for not being able to figure this out. And there's also some DSLR apps you can download for your phone that will give you more finite control over f-stops and shutter on your cell phone camera. But
is that Apple only, or is that also true of Android?
I'm actually using an Android myself. And I think
which one, if I might ask?
Oh gosh, I think I'm using like an S7. It's a couple of years old.
All right. I've got an S8 plus. So in theory, I should be able to do what I need to do with it, is what you're suggesting.
Yeah. And like I said, there's a DSLR, there's DSLR apps, free apps that you can get finite control over the f-stop and shutter. But sometimes you just need a camera with better control and better lenses, you know? So every cameras are a tool, you know, going out and buying a $2,000 digital SLR is not going to make you a better photographer.
Right.
It's going to make you a photographer with a $2,000 DSLR. I mean, quite frankly, right. It's like, and I hate to say this, I'm not bashing our industry friends, but buying a $300 locomotive doesn't make you a better modeler. It makes
That's
you a
right.
modeler with a $300 locomotive. It's what you do with that locomotive. It's how you're using it. And I'm not discouraging anyone from buying models that they enjoy. But, you know, again, it's when I was a kid, I thought buying, you know, a Kato SD45 made you an expert modeler because, right, you pull it out of the box and it looks amazing, right? And it runs amazing. You know, but that doesn't mean that the Atherin Blue Box is no better or worse. It's, I think we forget that a lot of what we use in this hobby, they're tools.
That's right.
Yeah, some tools are better than others, but buying the most expensive thing doesn't automatically mean that you've acquired a skill that you didn't before have.
Honestly, on the railroad, if you were at an op session, you would see locomotives from all the builders intermixed freely and be, I think, utterly unaware of one versus the other, unless you were, unless you were really like stopping to examine it with a critical eye, you know, close up. But it's not really what you're doing during an op session. You know, you're experiencing the railroad, you're experiencing the sounds and the, you know, thinking about the operations and what have you. And I try to have all of that be in harmony. And when it is, the level of individual detail of the individual pieces is a lot less critical. Where you notice it most, I find, is when you take a good digital photo of something and then you look at it, that will largely be unforgiving of anything. See everything, you know. I originally started using it as a modeling tool for that purpose, you know.
And it definitely helps. We were doing a photo shoot on the old RIT layout in 2012 before we tore it down. And I was using a mix of different cameras, point and shoots, DSLRs. And, you know, we'd set up the lighting, set up a scene, shoot, download to the computer, you know, look it on the big screen. It's like, oh, this looks really good. Oh, man, look at that big dust bunny, you know, or.
Exactly.
You don't see it until it's on the screen.
With that corner of that building not planted, you know.
Exactly. Right.
That's what happened in some of the original, some of those test shots I sent to you. I looked at some of those pictures and I said, whoa, I never got back to do, you know, X.
Right.
So that's kind of what I went around doing. And I hope you'll work with me. I'm going to give it a best effort on these final photographs here, but it'll be very interesting to see what feedback I'll get from you.
And I think at the end of the day, you know, as much as photography is about sharing your work with others, it can also, like you said, be a great modeling tool where you can really see, you know, you go down to your layout and you don't notice that this street light has been knocked off its base for a year.
Exactly. Right?
Or you don't notice that, oh, look, there's a plaster chip here, or, oh, look, this is really dusty. And when I touched it, my fingerprints here.
Right.
So it's not about being a perfectionist, but it's like, you always want to put your best foot forward. Right. So
absolutely.
I think it's great. It's one thing when you're building a model and you give it that first coat of primer, because what does the primer do? It unifies the model, but also shows you where the flaws are.
Absolutely.
So taking a picture, it shows you, not only does it unify the scene that you spent so much time building, shows you, oh, hey, look, that building is not planted. Oh, look, that street light's off its base. And it makes you a better modeler.
Well, whenever I take those kinds of photos, I'm fully prepared to go back and correct everything that they reveal and then do them again.
No, I think that's part of it as well. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really good overview of everything, and I think that the good news is I was able to MacGyver a fix for my water leak, to bring this full circle.
Oh, that's good.
I actually used a certain kind of silicone tape and a nylon tie wrap, and the silicone kind of sealed the pinhole, and the tie wrap provided enough pressure on the pinhole so that it's a very, very, very small drip at this point, which is good because they're not coming here for 10 days to fix it. So,
oh, geez.
But my goal is to get my pictures taken this week and put things together for you and get it sent off, and we'll see how it goes.
That sounds great. I'm looking forward to it, Mike.
Otto, thanks for being a guest on the podcast. And
thanks for having me here. Yeah, it's great.
I think that particularly now, this is a good way for everybody to stay connected. So I appreciate you being a guest and being a total pro.
Thank you very much. Thanks again for having us. And I hope to see you all in person very soon.
Yes, that's true. Thanks, everybody.